First of all, I wanted to just start out with one GC3 related item for everyone on the line as a reminder to register for our 2010 Innovators Roundtable that will be held on April 26th through 28th by Cisco in Houston, Texas. I'm sure everyone has received a number of emails about all of our interesting agenda items, but just a few to note that John Warner, one of the fathers of green chemistry, will be there for a keynote address. There will be a breakfast discussion featuring Kristen and her colleagues from the Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology at Rice University. There will also be five stimulating panel discussions, as well as work groups and focus on the success and direction of the GC3 working group projects. So for more details on the agenda and the registration process, please visit our website. Hopefully it will still be available sometime shortly. Since we are without our webinar capabilities today, we'll just hopefully hold all the questions till the end after Kristen's done with her presentation, and then we can have a discussion after that. Okay, so today's webinar is Nanotechnology and the Environment, Benefits and Risks. Nanotechnology is a broad area of technology that has already begun to affect every sector of product development, from arsenic sponges to cancer-killing nanoshells. Precisely engineered matter at the nanoscale can result in products that enhance quality of life and the environment. However, novel properties may result in unwanted impacts on living organisms, a prospect that has undercut some of the widespread enthusiasm about nano-enabled products. Dr. Kristen Kulininski, Director of the International Council on Nanotechnology and Executive Director of the Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology, will summarize the state of knowledge about nanoscale materials' potential health and environmental impacts, as well as introduce new mechanisms for sharing information about responsible use. Thank you, Kristen, for being here, and now I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Jessica. It's my pleasure to introduce some topics to you today. If you haven't heard that much about nanotechnology, I would encourage you to go and check your email and see if you did receive the PDF version of my slides. If you pull those up, I think it would enhance our time today, because it is a very visual subject, nanotechnology, and it's really hard to give a nanotechnology talk without lots of pretty pictures of nanoparticles. What I'm going to do is summarize the work of the Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology as it relates to improving the environment, and then talk about the risk side of the equation as well. So we've always, within our center, I'm on slide two now, have had a dual focus, dual focuses. The first dual focus is biology and engineering. So we, as a research center, focus on looking at functional nanoparticles and then getting them to do things, or studying what they do when they move into an environment where water is the primary solvent. And that includes living organisms, like people and mice, and the environment as well, where water is the solvent of life. So what we're looking at is understanding how what are traditionally thought of as inorganic, insoluble nanoparticles, and understanding how to change them to become soluble, and then understanding how to exploit their unique features to improve human health and the environment, while also the other dichotomy that we've always had within our center is understanding the risk questions as well. So that second focus we really look at is two sides of the same coin. If we're going to look at nanoparticles having an impact on human health and the environment, the same set of research questions needs to be addressed to make a useful technology application, as well as to understand the potential risks that might occur to living organisms as a result of exposure to these nanoparticles. So we were established, our research center, CBEN I'll call it from now on, Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology, was established in 2001 as one of the first nanotechnology science and engineering centers funded by the National Science Foundation. We have a 10-year lifespan and are actively looking at keeping some of those key elements of the program going through future grant making and other opportunities. Professor Vicki Colvin, a fellow chemist, is the director of CBEN. Moving on to the next slide now, one of the things that CBEN has a mandate to do, in addition to doing top quality fundamental and applied research, is educational outreach, workforce training, and what the NSF calls knowledge transfer. And when we were talking in the early days, early for this topic, about the potential risks of nanomaterials. Companies and others were coming to us and saying, you know, there aren't really too many people talking about this part of nanotechnology. I really would like to understand what people in government think about this, what people in civil society organizations think about it, and, you know, how can we all get together and figure out what the challenges are and work together to address them. And so because of that, those conversations that we had in the early days, we decided to create a sort of spin-off of CBEN called the International Council on Nanotechnology, or ICON, which I direct, which is a multi-stakeholder group that looks at potential risks of nanomaterials and develops and communicates information to address them. We're not doing the research within ICON, but we're, as you'll see, identifying several tools that help people figure out what the key issues are that can help drive research toward the most critical knowledge gaps and closing those gaps. So we believe ourselves to be grounded in the science, the scientific questions about risk, of which there are many, and are working to be stewards for sustainability so that engineered nanomaterials can be useful for society without bringing a whole lot of attendant problems with them. So moving on to the next slide, what is nanotechnology? If you haven't been introduced to this topic, then very simply, it's the study and use of materials with nanometer scale dimensions. So if you think about a scale bar starting at a kilometer and moving down to by powers of 1,000, a kilometer we can think of as, you know, people don't understand what that means. It's the size of a mountain, perhaps. A meter is the size of a child, 1,000 times smaller. Going down to the millimeter now, we're at the size scale of insects, ants, and things like that. Moving down to the microns, that's 10 to the minus 6 meters. This is beyond, just beyond our visual acuity. We can't see this without a microscope, but we're talking about bacteria and other living organisms, microbes. And then 1,000 times smaller than those items are the nanometer scale objects. And these are really large molecules or clusters of atoms or clusters of molecules, crystalline structures, that typically are measured between 1 and 100 nanometers on a side. So the size regime of nanoscale science coincides with and interacts with important size scales in biology and environmental science. But we're going to focus today on nanomaterials, particularly a subset of nanotechnology. And nanomaterials simply are materials, again, collections of atoms, molecules, that have one dimension between 1 and 100 nanometers. Well, many things can be defined that way, but what makes nanomaterials different from other objects in that size scale are that something special should happen because of that size scale. We should have some kind of special property emerge that results from the size scale, and there are physical laws that help us understand why that size scale is important as we move from the world of atoms, which is governed by quantum mechanics, up to the world of our macroscopic experience, which is governed by Newtonian mechanics and another classical mechanics. It's not a physics lesson, but that's why this nanoscale regime is so interesting, because as we move from the atomic world to the macroscopic world, we're moving through the nanometer size scale, and that's where the one world starts to transform into the other.
Kristen, this is Jessica. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but now the internet is working, so if people want to take a minute and so Kristen can upload her slides, the link that was provided in all the emails previous to this should now be working, and we'll just take a minute to, it should just be a minute to get the slides going once Kristen logs on.
Okay, now what do I do?
Okay, are you
on?
Okay, now I'll make you the presenter, and then you should have, okay, so you're the presenter now, and it will ask you what you want to do, and you can just click share presentation and upload a PowerPoint or PDF document.
Okay, so I'm going to browse, all right.
Everyone on the line, thank you so much for your patience today. I'm very sorry about the technical difficulties, but hopefully we will be all set now.
Okay. Okay, it's loading.
Okay, I think it is working.
And I see an X in the corner.
Okay, we can see your slides now.
You can see them?
Yes.
Okay, I can.
Oh, no.
All right, what slide is showing right now?
It's just the very first slide.
All right, well, how am I going to navigate if I can't see it? All right, I'm going to switch web browsers and see if that works.
Okay.
Trenton Boyd.
You may also just want to try refreshing your browser window. That worked for me.
Okay. Okay, now sharing. All right, it doesn't appear to be letting me share again.
Okay, I've given
you
Okay,
you just did it. Yeah. Good. Okay, hooray. Good, it was a browser issue.
Okay, great.
All right, so we're going to skip ahead to... There's the icon. Oh, slides are a little messed up. All right, that's okay. We'll persevere. All right, so nanomaterials, as I said before, materials, special properties due to the physical laws that are operant as we move from the very small to the very large. So now when we talk about nanomaterials, we must acknowledge that there are naturally occurring nanomaterials, things that are present from any time you burn something, you create a whole variety of different particles, many of which are in the nanoscale. And volcanic ash viruses could be considered to be nanoparticles. They are of the right size scale. Then there are things that we're producing, but as an accident of some other process. So those are the human origin incidental nanomaterials. Things like cooking smoke, diesel exhaust, welding fumes. These are not intentionally designed, but as a result of some other process, and usually something that we want to avoid becoming exposed to. But the ones that we're going to talk about are the human origin.
Monica, call Megan.
Sorry.
Human origin or engineered nanomaterials, also called manufactured nanomaterials. These are the materials that we're intentionally producing for some technological application or for study because they have cool properties. And we can find that nanomaterials can be created out of many, many different types of chemical substances, including metals such as silver and gold. Quantum dots are semiconducting nanomaterials. The carbon-based nanomaterials known as buckyballs or nanotubes, of course, Rice played a key role in bringing those to light as Professors Rick Smalley and Bob Curl were doing work here at Rice with Harry Croteau when the buckyball was discovered. Sunscreen pigments, these are oxide materials, titanium dioxide or zinc oxide, which are used not only in sunscreen pigments but in a whole variety of different consumer applications, including window coatings, thin films, antibacterial properties, and so forth. Nanocapsules, these are just some examples. But these are the ones that we're talking about today, the materials that we're intentionally designing to do something. So when I talk about nanomaterials, this is what I mean. Okay. Size-dependent properties. Depending on the type of nanoparticle that you're talking about, you might get a different size-dependent effect. So, for example, in iron oxide, also called magnetite, you see some electron micrograph images of each one of these dots is a little particle. It turns out those have size-dependent magnitude. Sorry?
I'm sorry, my slide didn't change. Are you on a new slide?
I'm on the slide entitled Size-Dependent Properties.
That's not showing on my screen. I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
If you're having trouble, I would suggest first refreshing your browser, and then hopefully it will refresh the slide.
So with iron oxide, we actually get size-dependent magnetism. A smaller magnet may actually be a more powerful magnet than one that's bigger in size, because all of the electrons might be spinning in the same direction, resulting in an overall higher net magnetic effect, something that's a little bit counterintuitive. The quantum dot emission picture isn't showing up here. I see just something that looks like a plug. So I'll move on to the gold. Gold is an interesting subject at the nanoscale because we assume that, you know, what we know about gold. Oh, what happened now? Left the meeting. Oh, no. Okay, here we go. Gold is a shiny metal. It's prized for its inertness, so we can use it as jewelry. It doesn't tarnish. It doesn't react very much. But when you make it nanoscale, it might change color. It might be red or gold in appearance. And as this graph is indicating, I realize it'd be hard for you to read, gold can be an extremely reactive substance at the nanoscale. A part of that is due to the fact that we're exposing a lot of the internal gold atoms to the surface when we make the particle very finely divided, and part of that has to do with quantum effects. But gold can turn into a reaction catalyst that can speed up the chemical reactions, something that we don't see from gold at the bulk scale. So magnetism, emission, reactivity, melting temperature, color, a whole variety of different physical and chemical properties may change or may be different at the nanoscale and may change throughout the nanoscale as this object gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, that's in China as well as the 95.
So we have to ask ourselves then if there are special chemical, physical, electrical, mechanical, thermal properties associated with matter at the nanoscale. Are there potentially special biological and environmental properties also that we should be aware of? And the answer, of course, is yes, absolutely.
Sorry, can I ask everybody else to go on mute? There's some background noise. It's very distracting.
So now I've got to figure out how I'm going to handle that.
Thanks.
So this is 85, and it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I can hear somebody talking in the background as well.
If everyone could mute their lines besides Kristen, I would appreciate that until we get to the discussion portion. Thank you.
Dimitri Bella?
Okay.
What is that, star six?
Can you tell them how they're supposed to mute their phones? Okay, I don't hear anybody else. We're at the slide now. You should be seeing a slide called Balancing the Benefits and Risks. Oh, as I said before, our center has always had a dual focus, and part of what we do is look on the application side, and particularly for this audience, I was asked to address environmental issues. So we're looking in our center, and I'll give you some key examples of projects, specific projects, and hopefully you'll have a chance to hear more about them in April, that apply nanoparticles particularly to the issue of cleaning up polluted water. And that's an application of nanotechnology that's very exciting and very promising. And there are other groups around the world that are working to take highly active nanoparticles and use them to break down pollutants in contaminated water. So it's a very exciting aspect of the work that's going on in CBEN. And as always, because we've always had this emphasis on the other side of the equation as well, looking at what we need to do to make sure that nanomaterials don't end up becoming environmental pollutants themselves. And we believe that there are similar scientific questions to be answered on both sides of that equation. So here are some beneficial application projects underway in our center. We have projects both in biological engineering and environmental engineering. We're famous for Professor Jennifer West's project to use Professor Naomi Hallis's gold nanoshells. This is a silicon core with a thin glass shell around it, and this material can actually absorb infrared light, turn it into infrared energy heat, and use that heat energy to raise the temperature of cancer cells beyond the point of viability. So you're literally cooking cancer cells to death, and this material right now is in phase two clinical trials for head and neck cancer, and it's looking very promising. The aspect of the nanotechnology that makes this such an interesting application is the fact that its size can be tuned to make it absorb in the infrared where your body tissue does not absorb, so your body tissue will not be affected except where the nanoshells are. And the size also comes into play in terms of the collecting of the nanoshells around the cancerous tumor cells. So the blood vessels that supply tumors are literally leaky. They have little gaps in them. They're rapidly developing in a poor quality, and these little nanoparticles can leak out of those and find their way to the cancer cells with or without a specific targeting agent. So it's a really very promising approach. Also, in this next image, Professor Rebecca Drezik and colleagues are working to use quantum dots to help light up cancer tissues for imaging purposes. So if you're trying to resect a tumor surgically and you want to make sure that you've reached the tumor margins and not left any cancerous cells behind, then this technique is being explored in the proof of concept phase right now to help determine where those cancer cells are. So the top line is a set of cancer cells that have been tagged with quantum dots that are highly emissive, fluorescence emission, and the lower cells are the same cells without the quantum dots, and you can see it's much easier to see the cells in the top. So that's another application. And then the really exciting work that's going on in water treatment, Professor Colvin's lab and others, I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about those two projects right now. Apologize, that wording up there says nanorust and novel derivatized fullerenes remove hazardous water pollution in municipal systems. So here's a project that's going on right now. In fact, the team is still down in Mexico working with municipal wastewater treatment plant operators to use nanoparticles to remove arsenic and other heavy metal contaminants. The water in this region of the world is contaminated from mining activities and as a result of natural levels of metal in the water. And they're embedding these little nano magnets of rust into a sand bed filter to remove the arsenic in a very clever way. Nanomagnetite is just nano rust, basically iron oxide, which has a chemical affinity for arsenic. Arsenic will bind to the surface of the nanomagnetite, and then you can use the magnetic field aspect of the nanoparticles to remove them from the water and make sure you've gotten all of them out. Fullerenes are photocatalytic materials, basically buckyballs and derivatives of buckyballs, and using UV radiation, UV light, as a disinfectant, they're also being explored in the same wastewater treatment plant. So that's a very exciting application, two applications really, of nanoparticles to clean up polluted water. A separate project from Professor Mike Wong's group uses mixed metal nanocrystals to reduce and detoxify chlorinated solvents such as trichloroethylene. So the concept here is that you take palladium core, you take a gold core nanoshell, and you start to seed the surface of that gold with palladium atoms. And you get a coverage, really only need about 11% palladium. And for some reason, he's not really sure yet why, though that combination of palladium on top of gold will break down chlorinated compounds extremely well. Palladium catalysts have been known to work in existing systems, but the materials that are in use right now are larger scale, and they require a lot of palladium. By putting the palladium on the gold, you can use less palladium, which is a more expensive metal than gold, and you reduce those particles to the nano size, thereby freeing up much more surface area, which makes them a lot more effective. So these palladium on gold catalysts have actually been shown to work 100 times better than existing technologies in the test bed. And Mike Wong has a project right now at a contaminated DuPont site in Kentucky that they're exploring right now in the field. So hopefully you'll be able to hear more from him in April as he's intending to come to the session. So those are two beneficial applications of nanomaterials to improve the environment. Of course, in our center, we're always thinking about the other side as well. And when we think about the risks of these materials, we're thinking about risks to workers, to consumers, and to the environment. The direct consumer focus is not a major one for us. We're not looking at product testing, for example, and there's actually very little of that going on. But we'll focus on what's happening in the environment and the worker population. So the first question we want to think about when we think about the risks of these exciting new materials is, what do we know about their potential impacts to cause harm to living organisms and the environment? And to know, it's not going to work, is it? Oh, no. Okay. This is a beautiful slide. Showed, I don't know if you can see it. Probably not. The federal funding in nano over the course of the last, I don't know, 6 years or so. And the nanotechnology funding through the National Nanotechnology Initiative has enjoyed a steady increase in funding, with including a nice bump in 2009 from stimulus money. If we look now at what fraction of that funding is directed toward risk-relevant research or nano-environment health and safety research, nano-EHS research, you would see that it's been between 3 to 7% of the total budget. And 7% is the high that is projected for this year based on the president's request. It's typically been more like 3 to 5%. So of all of the billions of dollars that are going into nanotechnology research, a very small fraction are directed toward understanding the potential risks of these materials. We catalog all the research on environment, health, and safety impacts of nanomaterials at our virtual journal site within the International Council on Nanotechnology. So if you go to the ICON site, icon.rice.edu, and you click in the upper right-hand corner on the virtual journal icon, you'll be taken to a site where you can search for all of the papers that have all the research papers that have come out of this. In fact, the ICON site is really a one-stop shop for everything you would possibly ever want to know about environment, health, and safety implications, the risk stuff. CBIN has a dual focus. ICON is more tightly focused on the risk stuff. And we catalog and document all of the newspaper articles, policy reports. If it's anything to do with this topic, we've got it. So the virtual journal collects the research papers, and it might surprise you to know that we have almost 4,000 individual papers that we've collected since we put this journal up in 2005 that have to do with this issue. So there's a wealth of information. The problem with it is how it is organized and the quality control of some of the data. So we actually update this weekly, and you can go and comment on individual papers, and it's a pretty slick little site. This is a graph that was intending to show the... I'm going to pull up my actual slide so I can talk from it while I'm speaking to you. The relative quantity of research based on the number of papers in our database that addresses hazard versus exposure. And what you would see if this graph was showing is that the hazard papers far outstrip the exposure papers. So what do I mean by this? Well, if we think about risk, risk is really a product of hazard and exposure. You have to understand what the toxicant will do. That's the hazard study. And then you have to understand if there's a possibility for that target organism to become exposed to that toxicant in a way that would produce the undesirable result. So of all the papers that have appeared in the virtual journal, and there's been a really huge increase in research in this area over the past decade, the overwhelming majority of papers are toxicity papers, hazard papers. You take nanoparticle X, you put it in some cells, you measure a lethal concentration of 50%, it kills 50% of the cells, you publish a paper. Or, you know, and in fact, most of the hazard papers are cytotoxicity papers, cell culture studies. So that's really good work. It's very important to, as a first test of a nanoparticle, to do a cytotoxicity study. It's fairly easy, quick, and can be used for comparative results. But the relevance of those studies, those hazard studies, to human health and to environmental impact are extremely limited. So we can't over-interpret what we're finding in that literature too much. And until we get more on the exposure side, we're really not going to have a clear picture, a quantitative picture of risk. Doesn't mean we can't do anything in the meantime, but we're not going to be able to, say, set an occupational exposure limit or an environmental release limit, you know, that a regulator could get their hands on and really enforce until we get that data gap filled. But what does the hazard literature say? Well, again, it's a large body of work, and it's very difficult to generalize and summarize it quickly. But some of the findings include that certain types of nanoparticles can cause fibrosis, There's particular concern about fibrous nanomaterials, including carbon nanotubes, that can't be cleared by the body's normal mechanisms and can result in granulomas and inflammation and potentially even some very deadly diseases have been linked to these materials. Again, those are hazard studies. Don't know whether the exposure is there and whether the exposure would occur in a form that would cause a hazard. One of the things about carbon nanotubes is they love to stick together. So we go to great lengths to individualize them in these experiments when, in fact, the type of nanoparticle or the form that someone might be exposed to might be very different and might never result in the kind of exposure that could cause the disease. But nonetheless, lots to be concerned about there. The small nature of nanoparticles does mean that some of them can end up in the gas exchange region of the lung, so there's an inhalation potential. And once they're in the body, there's a large body of work from air pollution epidemiology that says you probably don't want large amounts of insoluble particles floating around your body. There's cardiovascular impacts from that that are parallel or correlated with or similar to what we would find from air pollution, although engineered nanoparticles have some distinctive features from air pollution. It's true that a fraction of air pollution is in the nanoscale and can be thought of as having some of similar consequences. Inflammation has been documented. Excellent work by Professor Gunter Oberdorster has shown that there's a potential pathway through inhalation along the olfactory nerve from your nose up into the brain for certain types of nanoparticles. A recent result have indicated that it may be possible for certain types of nanoparticles to pass across the placenta. Don't know what the outcome of that would be, whether or not that's going to result in harm to the fetus. That has not been documented. But there are these hazard studies which have raised enough concern to make this topic a compelling one, to grow an entire international research community around these shorthand notation nanotoxicology or nano-EHS work. It's real, and it needs to be considered.
Kristen, I also want to let you know that in the meantime, since some of the slides weren't showing up perfectly, I emailed out all of the slides to everyone so they can reference those for the graphs that you were speaking to earlier.
Great. So if you go to slide 18 now, the information needs for nano impact. What we tried to do within ICON is bring together the world's experts to understand what do we need to know about these nanomaterials to be able to predict their behavior. If we wanted to get toward structure-activity relationships, you know, what are we supposed to be measuring? And that's actually a very difficult question to answer. But through a series of two workshops, we came up with some immediate and critical information needs that we're hoping the funding agencies and researchers will respond to try to close those knowledge gaps. The first workshop looked at nanomaterial classes. Can we look at whether it's a carbon nanoparticle versus a quantum dot versus a titanium dioxide and say anything about them based on their chemical composition? And the answer was pretty much no. It's more complicated than that. What we really need to understand is how nanomaterials change throughout their life cycle and how we can identify the important physical characteristics, physical and chemical characteristics of those nanoparticles as they change. So, for example, if we take, again, this carbon nanotube, if it's individualized, you know, it might, and if it's long and stiff and looks like a needle, you know, it might behave a certain way, but once it gets into the body, is it going to become coated with proteins, or is it going to fold up, or is it going to agglomerate with other nanoparticles and form a bundle, which would behave very differently? How does, you know, that's what we really need to answer, not is it carbon versus titanium dioxide, but what does it look like and how is it interacting in the environment where it is and how does that change? And those tools are very rudimentary for tracking those changes and understanding what impacts they might have on health, for example. And then we need to correlate the functional properties of the nanomaterials with the potential for biointeraction. So again, not what it is, but what it does. And then the second workshop really addressed the issue of prediction much more directly. And the two primary conclusions there, information needs, were we need models for how nanomaterial properties control biointeractions at their surfaces. So if a nanoparticle gets into the body or into the environment and natural organic material or proteins in your bloodstream end up coating that in a dynamic way, how does that change the interaction of that nanoparticle with the body? I mean, biologists and biochemists and medical researchers do this all the time. They take something nasty and they put a biocompatible polymer coating on top of it so that the body is shielded somewhat from the toxic effects of that material, or it, you know, the material is released in a controlled way, all kinds of tools like that. Nanoparticles will have some of the same strategies potentially for controlling their toxicity or their what the environment around them is exposed to. And then all kinds of research protocol questions about how you measure dose and dose rate. You know, people are used to using mass or concentration, and for nanoparticles it really might be particle number or surface area. So the outcome, generally speaking, was that people, these experts, really believe that predicting nanobio interactions, that is, understanding what the nanoparticle is and then going from that understanding to a prediction of how it will interact in various environments, including the body or a sand bed in the natural environment. Really, we're 10 years away from that. This was a couple years ago, so maybe we're only 7 years away from that now, but still, it's a complex problem, and a lot of work needs to be done to get toward that goal. Moving on now more directly to the environment, the next graph on slide 19 shows a similar critical knowledge gap. And fortunately, I put the key statement right up there in the title for those of you who can't see it. All of the papers in the virtual journal, last year we put over 700 of them in a single year. Of those, only 7% of all of that nano impacts literature addresses environmental impacts. So a lot of the work, again, has been on the health side, hazard studies and so forth. Very little of it has been on the environmental side. And that's a critical knowledge gap that we need to address, and that the National Science Foundation, for example, recently funded two whole centers to look at the environmental side, although one of them is really more of a health-focused center. So there's work going on in this area, but it's lagging behind the health research. Next, oh good, this picture came up, because this would have been hard to walk through without it. We're looking at how nanoparticles are modified in the environment. So if we start over here on the left-hand side, here's our naked nanoparticle. And maybe it's got a core and a shell coating around it, like a nano shell or some other kind of structure like that. We can identify four major types of things that can happen to that, fates of that particle. It could dissolve. The particle could dissolve in exposure to water, sunlight, oxygen, organisms in the environment, and dissolve, and then the dissolution products or the nanoparticle itself could undergo chemical reaction. What do we know about that? Not very much. How are the nanoparticles going to affect microbial populations? That's a particular area of expertise, Pedro Alvarez, here in our center. And then physical mechanisms of change for the nanoparticle might include them aggregating. I've mentioned that before in a health context. Do the particles that were once separated an individual now aggregate and clump together, and does that cause them to settle out on the bottom of a river or otherwise impact their ability to transport to other locations? That's another whole area that needs to be studied. Surface modifications, adsorption and desorption of natural organic matter or pollutants onto the surface could make nanoparticles capable of transporting toxicants from where they are to where they would not have expected to go otherwise, or could be used as a tool to remove toxicants, like the arsenic project I mentioned before. And then, finally, the least exciting thing that could happen to them could be they just sit there. Persistent nanomaterials just sit there like little rocks in the environment and don't interact. And, you know, what is the consequence long-term of that, and how long can that state be sustained in the natural environment? So this is a whole area of research that's really been underexplored and needs to get a lot more attention as the community starts to think about a fuller life cycle approach to these materials rather than focusing just on, you know, the hazard side of things. All right, this one is, it looks like it only got 20, stopping at 20. What do I do here? Oh, okay. So while that's loading, if it will load, we held another workshop specifically on the environment. What do we need to know to advance eco-responsible design and disposal of engineered nanomaterials? And that workshop was held just over a year ago. And on the design side, what we found is that we need tools to measure nanoparticles in the environment. We need to be able to track them. We need structure-activity relationships for environmental exposures and hazards as well as for human health and other health-related. We need better models to predict how nanomaterials move through the environment and better tools for predicting their bioavailability in the natural environment. On the disposal side, there's just almost nothing that we do know at this point. We need to understand release and exposure scenarios based on current understanding of production and disposal. Where are the nanoparticles likely to enter the natural environment and in what quantities and in what forms? Very, very limited information. This would be information that almost certainly would have to come with great cooperation from industry. There's a whole area of recycling and reclamation and reuse of nanomaterials. As nanomaterials enter building materials and automobile parts and other kinds of materials that end up getting recycled or reused, what are the impacts to the environment of having nanoparticles in those products? Whole set of emerging issues for environmental protection infrastructure. Do landfill liners protect against leaching of nanoparticles? Do we need new regulatory tools? And in general, this is the great, these are great unexplored questions, particularly on the environmental side in general. Okay, moving on. The next slide is a little project vignette from CBEN that addresses one aspect of environmental implications of nanoparticles. The title of the slide is Quantum Dot Weathering Results in Microbial Toxicity. So one of the things that researchers in our center wanted to explore was whether nanoparticles will break down in the natural environment. And quantum dots are made out of materials like cadmium. Cadmium selenide, in fact, is one of the most applications, the most significant quantum dot from an applications perspective, has materials like cadmium and selenium or telluride in them. And so often these things are coated to make them more biocompatible. And the question was, what's the fate of those coatings under normal environmental conditions? And so two sets of nanoparticles were tested in this study. Nano-C60, or NC60, which is an aggregate of individual C60 molecules that forms a crystalline structure, a crystalline aggregate, and the quantum dots. And they found that, good news and bad news, quantum dots can be degraded in the natural environment and release toxic metals. And that's dependent on the pH of the surrounding soil or medium in which it is. And that in neutral pH, they don't kill bacteria, which is probably good news in the environment. The C60 is known to be a strong antibacterial agent. And the good news in this case is that when C60 or nano-C60 gets out to the natural environment, natural organic matter will sorb onto its surface and effectively cloak the contents from the environment. And so it's possible that in the natural environment, a lot of these materials will just kind of get lost by all the stuff that gunks up their surfaces. That may be true for some of the nanoparticles. So clearly, you know, depending on the particular type of nanoparticle and the conditions under which it finds itself, you may have a good news or a bad news scenario on your hands. But these are very particular, specific examples, and we can't really generalize yet, which is a problem for, you know, for risk assessment and risk management. Okay, we're back on here. Moving now to the issue of worker safety. We and I kind of had a particular interest in the worker population, primarily because they really are the first on the front lines of nanoparticle exposure, potentially. They are the ones who are likely to come into contact with native nanoparticles in their raw form, be formulating and manipulating them in a variety of different tasks in the workplace, and have exposures that are more chronic because it's their job. This is what they're doing for, you know, 8 hours a day or whatever. So we all the concerns that we have about the environment and the consumer population are still there, but the workers really are a high priority as well. And so we wanted to know what people were doing and how they were working with nanoparticles. And so we asked. Back in 2006, we published a survey that was done by researchers at the University of California, Santa Barbara, with ICON sponsorship and guidance. And we found that people in industry primarily, who we were surveying here, were really interested in getting better information on how to handle these materials safely. And they believed that there were special risks associated with handling nanomaterials. All those hazard studies and the news reporting and attention they received from the media kind of started to seep into their psyche, and said, okay, maybe there's something here, or maybe we ought to figure out if we're handling these materials safely. It's a very complicated and data-rich survey. I'm really glossing over it. I encourage you to go to our website and download it for free. You can look at that. And the survey, I'm pleased to report, is being repeated right now. So we may get an update from, you know, what is now 3 to 4 years later on to see if anything has changed. In the meantime, we took that as a call to action. Okay, people are handling nanomaterials right now. They believe there are special risks. They believe that if they had better information and guidance, they could do a better job of protecting their workers. What do they need to know, and where are they going to get that information? And so going back to that virtual journal again, this is slide 25 of 37, we can look at the data, the research data that's been generated on environment, health, and safety implications, the whole subject, and you've seen that graph before. And now if we look at, for just those papers that are highly occupationally relevant, what gloves do I wear when I'm working with quantum dots? Do I need a respirator when I'm handling carbon nanotubes? And that research is almost non-existent. It's probably the biggest data gap there is right now. We just don't have the knowledge base to inform occupational practice specific to nanoparticles. There are resources for handling nanoparticles out there. I don't want you to leave you with the impression that there's nothing, no guidance for people. In those years since the survey was published, a lot of work has been done. And particularly I would draw your attention to the NIOSH document, Approaches to Safe Nanotechnology, which is a wonderful resource. And NIOSH is doing amazing work in all aspects of nanosafety, including toxicology research, exposure assessments. They're doing field studies, going out and looking at small businesses with their invitation to determine whether there's a problem and what fixes can be implemented. And they have some really good news stories from that work, indicating that we don't need to necessarily reinvent the wheel. Counterparts in other countries, other areas of the world are also doing similar work and publishing these mostly high-level guidance documents to inform occupational practice. And then there are some standards that directly address that, including one that I worked on within ASTM, Standard Guide for Handling Unbound Engineered Nanoparticles in Occupational Settings. So there's information out there, but the problem with this information is that it's pretty scattered. If we look at all these thousands of pages of reports, we will find an acknowledgement that nanomaterial behavior differs from that of non-nanoscale analogs. You take the same material that you understand and know how to work with, and you make it nanoscale, and suddenly you have a different material with different properties that may require different handling. They all acknowledge that. Some nanomaterials may pose health risks if exposure is present. Again, we know from the hazard studies that there may be reason to be cautious, but the exposure studies are not there to understand how to put this together in a comprehensive risk package. And hazard, so that's the third bullet, hazard and exposure do not yet provide a clear picture of risk. So the bottom line recommendation, if I can grossly oversimplify these hundreds of pages of documents, is that minimizing exposure to nanomaterials is prudent. But there are barriers to sharing information. This next slide doesn't really have any text on it. It just shows the barriers are language. So, you know, who among us is really reading the German and French documents that may have good stuff in them? Not really too many people I know outside of those countries. Nanomaterial diversity means that it's difficult to make general conclusions and guidance. So we may have to take it on a case-by-case basis. People are strapped for time, and time is money in some cases, particularly in small businesses that have a difficult time paying a lot of attention to this as they're trying to get products out the door. And then legal challenges to companies that are doing good work in this area, whose attorneys don't want them to talk about it because they may expose themselves to liability. So how do we get information out to the communities to inform good practice? And that is the big question. On slide 29, how do we get timely, practical, and high-quality information out to all of the target populations? And that leads me to my final few slides here, talking about the Good Nano Guide. This is a site that's a wiki, basically, where we're collecting information on how to handle engineered nanomaterials safely. You can find it at goodnanoguide.org. We just launched it a little bit less than a year ago, and it's really got some good stuff on it. If you are interested in going and checking it out, it's easy to do. All you have to do is go to the site and poke around. And if this were, if I had any confidence in the screen sharing, I would actually take you to the site, but I'm not going to try to do that. But you can just view everything that's on the site as you could any other open website. If you want to comment on what's there, you have to register as a community member. And if you want to actually post information for others, then you need to register as an expert provider. And an implementation committee of experts in nanotechnology and safety, occupational health, will review your application and make sure that you have some authority to share the information you're sharing. They're pretty conservative right now. They want to make sure all the information is good quality. Content is organized in three ways, through an expert portal, an intermediate portal, and a basic portal. The basic portal just says, you know, do you know what nanotechnology is? No? Okay, go here. We're really not intending this to be a what is nanotechnology site, but if people come and stumble on the site, then they can find out a little bit about that. The intermediate site is really for, is a reference manual, A to Z approach to looking at occupational safety. And it's based largely on a Department of Energy document, goes through a comprehensive approach to occupational safety with an emphasis on nanomaterials. And then the expert matrix is really the unique feature of this site. It takes a sort of control banding approach, if you understand what that means. If not, it's not important. Basically, it's a qualitative risk assessment. So you look at the task that the worker is involved in, whether it's mixing or machining or pouring or cleaning up a spill, and the form of the nanoparticle that is involved in that task. So the assertion here is that it matters more whether the compound is a dry powder where there might be a potential for inhalation than it does versus something that's bound up in a solid matrix than it does whether it's carbon or titanium dioxide. So it doesn't matter what the particle is. It matters the form that it's in. And so the emphasis shifts from hazard, which is kind of associated with the what the particle is, to the exposure side. Is there a potential for inhalation, for dermal penetration, and what would I need to do to prevent that exposure? So it's a qualitative approach that looks at the form of the nanoparticle and considers a variety of different tasks that might be relevant in an occupational setting. And we're looking to, you know, fill this in as new information becomes available. In addition to this expert matrix, there are material-specific protocols that say, here's what you do if you are decommissioning a carbon nanotube reactor, and you want to make sure that the workers on that site are not getting exposed to a potential hazard. As the library of those specific protocols grows, you know, we would be thrilled to have any contributions we have from authoritative sources.
Kristen, so we're wrapping up on 3 o'clock right now. So I want for everyone that's been so patient and everything, I want to give them a few minutes to ask questions. So,
well, this is my last slide.
Great, excellent, thank you.
So in the next few months, what we're going to be doing is trying to get more of those process-specific protocols, engage researchers or industry people as users, contributors, or implementation committee members, this is like our editorial board, and to sustain the Good Nano Guide as an open access resource so that it always remains freely available to anyone who wants it. You can, again, here's our sponsors for the Good Nano Guide, and you can see that at goodnanoguide.org. And then just to wrap up, I'd like to say that I would assert that research on nano impact is accelerating. Those graphs, you know, document that pretty clearly. But there are many knowledge gaps in exposure, in environmental assessment, and in occupational safety that need to be filled to ensure the sustainable use of nanomaterials. And the people in industry are key stakeholders in these issues. Just finally, I'd like to say that we will be a group of us coming to your meeting in April. Qilin Li, Jin Lu, and Mike Wong are all on the sunny side of the street. They're all doing applications work. And we'll be happy to talk to you about how nanoparticles will save the environment. And I'll be there to join them. Sorry this didn't work out. I hope it was somewhat possible to follow without the slides. And if we have time for questions, I'd happy to take some.
Great. Thank you so much.
I have a question. Nathan.
Feel free to go ahead.
This is Lynn Katz-Cherry from the Great Lakes Green Chemistry Network. Thank you for this really, really interesting presentation. But I just have to comment that it seems to me that the applications are really pretty far ahead of the understanding of the implications of those and the effects of those applications. And that kind of is concerning to me because it seems to me that we're seeing a repeat in the field of nano that we've seen with toxic chemicals, that the information comes long after the exposure. And I'm wondering whether your centers are working with any people from the green chemistry community who are looking at green chemistry principles in the context of nano to, figure out how to design nanoparticles that have less hazard.
That's an excellent point. And I would just say that, you know, back in 2001 when we started to raise these issues about environmental impact and health impacts, people thought we were nuts. People thought, you know, well, there's nothing to talk about yet because there are no products. And here we are nearly 10 years later, we're still asking the same questions. And meanwhile, the applications have moved, you know, forward at a blistering pace, and we do see a large number, unsubstantiated but difficult to quantify, number of products actually on the marketplace. So part of me thinks that people just would have paid more attention to us back in 2001. We did try to get out ahead of this in our center. The second question is... The second part of your question had to do with...
Working with the green chemistry community.
Working with green chemistry. Yeah, there have been some attempts to do that. Barb Karn at the EPA is probably the person who's tried the hardest to get the nano community and the green chemistry community together. And for some reason, you know, there just hasn't been the right vehicle or the right mechanism to do that. There have been some studies which have looked at, for example, life cycle assessment of nanoparticle production. I'm thinking of one particular one that looked at all of the hydrocarbons that are produced and released during the production of a particular type of nanoparticle as a way of saying, you know, there has to be a better way to make these things. Mike Wong, who you know, will be at the meeting next month, has published a really interesting study looking at making quantum dot tetrapods in a very environmentally benign way. These are particles that could be the platform for the next generation of solar technology, but he's found a way to make them basically using shampoo, basically using an emulsion that's very environmentally benign. So there is some thinking in the community about how to make these things in a greener way. But the full collision of the nanotechnology community and the green chemistry community has really not happened yet.
If Kristen will stay on the line, if people have a couple more questions for her. I know that we're over time at this point, but if there are other questions. Okay, well, at this point, since we are past 3 o'clock, I will start winding down, and if there are any last pressing questions, one more opportunity, but we will have a full opportunity at the GC3 Roundtable coming up next month to ask Kristen and her colleagues lots of things that might come into our heads from now until then. And thank you again, Kristen, for a great presentation. It was very informative. And I will be posting the slides to the GC3 website as well as the recording of the presentation, and we'll email the listserv when those are available. So,
okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you
for your patience.
Bye-bye.